Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you. It's the world's biggest threat and extraordinary foe to mankind, but it's of our own doing, and it'll take all of us to overcome it. Hello, everyone. I'm Tamika Lundy. Welcome to University Drive. Today, we have two incredible guests who are helping to lead the charge for climate action from a different perspective. We have planned an enlightening conversation that will explore their experiences, challenges, and hopes for a world that flourishes and citizens actively participate in its survival. Joining us are our youth climate ambassadors for the Bahamas, Ashante Russell and Stephen Hunter II. Thanks for making University Drive a part of your busy schedule. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Ms. Lundy. Happy to be here.
And we're happy that we could finally make this happen. It's been in the works for quite a while, and we're just glad that we're able to pin you down and have what I think is going to be a compelling conversation. Ashante, we'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about your background, and how is it that you came to be one of two current youth climate ambassadors for the Bahamas? And then we'll go next to Stephen.
In terms of my background, I've been operating more so in the climate change space, specifically for about 5 years now. Yeah, this year makes about five. So essentially growing up, we being my siblings, we had a very intimate relationship with outside the environment and all the things that were attributed with it. And in that experience, I got the firsthand ability to be able to kind of notice when things began to change. And it was subtle at first, but it began to progressively go downhill, if I can say. And the definite turning point, especially considering the fact that my career aspirations are specifically within conservation research, Hurricane Dorian was definitely that catalyst that pushed me more so to want to work in the international space. So most of my background has been a combination of that national perspective coupled with the international procedures and meeting spaces. So I've been able to travel to various conferences and participate in various international programs that have bolstered and reinforced the entire climate change resilience perspective from small island developing states, because so much of the times we're not in those rooms and in those spaces. So I've been able to actually act as a youth catalyst in that regard. And it's proven to be very beneficial heading into so many different conversations currently.
That's all quite intriguing that someone of your age would be in so heavily involved and so minded about the importance of being in those spaces and working in the realm that you're working in. And Stephen, what about you? Tell us a little bit about yourself and also what led you to becoming one of the current youth climate ambassadors.
I always possessed an interest for the environment since I was, I would say, about 8 years old. And I enjoyed subjects such as geography, physics, and mathematics. So I actually decided to pursue a degree in meteorology, which encompasses all of those subjects. And in addition to that, my neighbor, Mr. Michael Stubbs, former deputy director of the Department of Meteorology, which I am currently employed, left an indelible mark on me growing up, as I was able to have conversations with him in terms of how you can utilize meteorology and atmospheric science to actually make a difference when it comes to research, because that's something I actually want to do when I go and pursue my master's degree. So that's a little bit about me on the academic side. I'm a relative newcomer when it comes to the climate change space and sphere. My learned friend Ashante has been in the sphere for about 4+ years. So I am a relative newcomer when it comes to that, but I also wrote a lot of articles in the University of the West Indies Center for Biosecurity Studies newsletter, where I co-authored and wrote articles on topics such as ranging from climate justice to renewable energy technologies. So although I did meteorology, I still have a good understanding of the environmental challenges that we face, especially in small island development states, because a lot of courses I would have done tied into my meteorology program.
One of the other things that you share in common is that you both have a connection to University of the Bahamas. For Shante,
Yes,
it's current,
indeed.
and for Stephen, it's in his recent
Alumni
past.
status.
So Ashante, tell us about your connection with UB.
So I'm a current biology with a minor in chemistry candidate for 2024. And essentially, when I enrolled in UB, my overall focus was not really to go into biology with chemistry. Now, I strictly wanted to either do biology or marine biology. And when I left and came back to the Bahamas, I found that the marine biology degree itself was dissolved and it was kind of encompassed into SIS. Now, I was given the advisement, considering what it was I wanted to do, to go broad really and just kind of go into biology with the chemistry. And it's proved to be beneficial because, yes, in terms of the social aspects of speaking in the climate change space and navigating through it, the SIS program and has been able to afford me that opportunity because I do strictly electives from that degree pathway. But I am specifically interested in research as well as theoretical application. So the mix between the two has proven really beneficial for me at this point, even though it keeps me up at night. It still has its basis in everything. And a lot of the things that I've been able to do, I've been able to tie directly to UB. So it's really something that I'm glad I chose to do in the long run and in the long term. So yeah, I'm very, very happy to be a Mingo.
No, nothing like being up at night and having red eyes at 4UB on the way to greatness to get your adrenaline pumping.
Yes,
Stephen, you remember
yes,
that,
sir.
Right? Because you also spent some time as a student at UB.
Oh, yes. And in the School of Mathematics, Physics, Mathematics, and Technology. So definitely.
And what was your experience like at UB as a student?
Yeah, so just to give some background to that, you know, when you first graduate school, high school, your parents always tell you, you know, go to UB, get your feet wet for a year or two. So that was actually the thinking behind me going to UB at first. And, you know, UB doesn't exactly have meteorology or atmospheric science currently, but they have physics and mathematics. So I ended up majoring in that particular subject matter for about 2.5 years. And then I transferred to the University of the West Indies. But during my time there, I could definitely say I forged a lot of lifelong relationships, had a wonderful experience. It was my first college experience because when I went to UE, you know, persons were kind of classifying me as a quote-unquote fresher or freshman, as they say over here in the Caribbean. But I was like, this is not my first college experience. You know, I have already went to UB and, you know, I'm pretty seasoned when it comes to that. So I definitely had a great experience, and I recommend anyone who's thinking about college or university to first try a UB. If you don't stick it out, at least, you know, give it a try. But, yeah.
So I have a question for both of you. Climate change and the youth space, from the youth perspective, through a youth lens, is there a difference? Is there something special about youth advocacy or youth education or youth activism when it comes to climate change or climate action?
Yeah, I'd say there is definitely a splicing perspective. So much of the time when you talk about climate change and the entire climate change community, it's heavily saturated in the experience of individuals from a, let's say, senior standing. But what it really means for young people, it's really a movement that is one part inclusive of energy and the needed bolstering in the space, as well as the honest truth of our survival. Because so much of the time, when we're talking to individuals and we're advocating for youth in this space, we're honestly advocating for our futures. We are completely understanding of what's going on. We're completely aware, and we have no choice but to be aware because everything is changing around us and has been changing around us since our generation came into existence. So we have no choice but to be more mindful. And even though in being mindful, sometimes the information is not disseminated as it should be, because there is still a very fine line in the sand that distinguishes our education and exposure to climate change resiliency and education and what it is that's been established for decades. It's a very cumbersome conversation, and it's coming to, I'd say, fruition in this particular year, because unfortunately, it's something you cannot ignore anymore. It's something that's become so in your face that you have no choice but to recognize it and to recognize the different perspectives that exist in this community. So it is definitively different, but it still equates to the same conversation that all of us, the older and the younger generations, have to be more mindful and more interested in collaborating for us to actually have a meaningful and long-lasting result in this conversation.
Yeah, and just to add to what Ashanti would have said, to give some background, for those who are listening about this youth climate ambassadorship, this ambassadorship was really created out of the need to have more youth involvement in the climate change space. So specifically in 2021 at COP26, which took place in Glasgow, Scotland, there was a lot of youth representation in general, and it was the first COP to have that much youth representation. But when it came to the small island nations like the Bahamas and the rest of the Caribbean, the youth involvement and presence was basically next to zero. So the Davis administration actually sought to change that by establishing this ambassadorship in 2022 with the first climate youth ambassadors, Maya Delaney and Bradley Watson. And now we are the second addition to that. So we were really brought in and instituted to kind of lead this movement in the climate change space in the Bahamas, because it's so critical to have that youth involvement, because it is an issue that's going to ultimately affect youth more so and disproportionately.
In your work as youth climate ambassadors, what has been the most important in terms of focus and in terms of outcomes up to now?
Well, one of the main things, or several of the main things actually, we've been striving to do since being instated is really bringing that parallel between education and exposure. Because so much of the time when we talk about anything from a theoretical standpoint, especially in the Bahamas, there is a disconnect. You can really and truly regurgitate information to young people as much as you want, but if you do not establish a tangible connection, it will literally run off like water over a dam. And that's been something we've been trying to essentially rectify since we came into office. So when our first event was one that we did in collaboration with the Youth of India Foundation. And in doing that, the reason we really wanted to foster a connection with a larger, more developed nation is to really bring about the conversation and perspective. Yes, we're more so, as a small island developing state, on the receiving end of everything that larger nations do. But at the end of the day, in order for things to be progressive, we have to begin to have these conversations. We have to begin to understand each other's perspective in order to be progressive. So much of the time, we kind of look at it as a you versus me, as opposed to you and me, in order for us to reach solutions. So that's one of the things we've kind of carried on to this point, striving for multi-generational and multi-sectorial connections, because we are a generation that, though we can sometimes be pegged as being very, very, very bullheaded, they often call us the microwave generation. Most of that comes from the fact that we know we are really operating on a very specific time frame. We don't have 30 more years to deliberate several conversations in the climate change space. We literally have been operating on a specific clock. And that's something we've internalized during our ambassadorship, because we know we're going to be in office for a specific amount of time. So we do have a specific amount of objectives we'd like to achieve. And I'd like to say that we've been doing a very good job at this point, because we've been able to engage young people from across the country in our first Bahamas Youth Climate Conference. And it was so momentous for us, because Not only was it the first conference to be held of that nature, but it was one in which we were able to pull together young people from several of the islands. So we've been making progressive steps up until this point to actually include, endorse, and expose young people as much as possible. And yes, a lot is still left to be done. But by establishing frameworks and guidelines and different operating standpoints, we are not only just doing something to encourage the generations to come, but we're setting a standard and a staple for other people to follow.
And Stephen, what's your view on connecting with young people?
Yeah, so as it pertains to connecting with young people specifically, again, just to add to the work we have done so far during this ambassadorship, our flagship event would have been the Bahamas Youth Climate Conference that took place on July 13 and 14. But since then, we have been engaged in a number of other workshops and engagements. One of them was Friends of the Environment, which, as you know, is based in Abaco. We had a little Zoom talk with them, with a few of the students who go there. And actually, early in the year before that, we had another engagement with a few of the public schools, namely S.E. McPherson. I think we had R.M. Bailey's, C.B. Bethel as well, right at the BAIC, Bahamas Agricultural and Industrial Corporation, where we talked about the importance of sustainable agriculture, how we can actually tie in 3D printing, which is an emerging technology. And it was actually a good thing to have that 3D printing aspect of it, because it kind of, you know, captured the attention of the students, because it's such a cool thing to look at. And the program coordinator at Project ICE, Christopher Heasty, was very instrumental in leading that workshop, where he was able to show the kids how he made an actual hydroponic stand from a 3D printer. So that was very cool as well. We also had a Climate Change Guardians workshop, in which we partnered with UNESCO and Mrs. Deidre Bevins at the Ministry of Education. That went very well. We had a number of students from the Family Islands as well as in New Providence. And just very recently, we also partnered with BRIEF in their recent Eco Schools workshop, which our Prime Minister, Minister of Environment, and current Minister of State, Mrs. Ian Lightbourne, attended as well. So we have been very active in this space, but we know it is important that we reach those on the Family Islands specifically, because we don't want climate change to seem like a Nassau-centric issue, because that's kind of the impression could come off us. So we really are hoping to expand our work throughout the length and breadth of the Bahamas over the course of our ambassadorship.
Shared responsibility and shared participation. I like it. Let's pause here for our first break. You're listening to University Drive. We'll have more after this.
Are you ready to take your knowledge or career to new heights? Don't wait to invest in your future. Do it now. How? Earn a professional development certificate from University of the Bahamas. Whether you're looking to enhance your leadership abilities, sharpen your technical skills, or explore a new field entirely, our Continuing Education and Lifelong Learning Center has the ideal course for you. We offer single-phase electrical, ethics and procurement, accounting for entrepreneurship, stop managing, start leading, dynamic presentations, digital marketing, superior customer service, and justice of the peace. We even have courses on smartphone photography, TikTok videos, defensive driving, and interacting with difficult people. Or open the door to new languages with English as a second language, conversational Chinese, and Spanish in the workplace. Our instructors are experts in their fields, and they're here to support you every step of the way. Call us at 302-4449. Enroll today.
Welcome back to University Drive. We're talking with Ashante Russell and Stephen Hunter II, our Youth Climate Ambassadors for the Bahamas. I'd like to continue this conversation about the action that's needed to save our planet from the wrath of climate change. We're talking about it from the youth perspective. And Ashante and Stephen, you both have been very busy attempting to heighten the education, the awareness, the advocacy about this matter. In fact, You both are right now out of the country attending another very important conference in Barbados. Tell us about what you've been doing up to now, over there in Barbados.
Yeah, so we arrived late yesterday evening. It was a
Yes.
very interesting experience. But essentially, the event that's going on is the Regional Conference of Youth for the Caribbean. So last year, July, we hosted the RCOI at UB, and it was a collaborative event in which young people from across the Bahamas and various other Caribbean countries all pulled together at the university. We had this conversation, especially heading into COP27, where the agenda topic was loss and damage. So we strive to build that necessary capacity and understanding as to, hey, we're going through this, we need this, but we need to understand the correlation between the two. So we had various workshops and various breakout sessions in order to build capacity and formulate that resounding one boy, one band, one voice. So now this year, we are currently in Barbados, where it's being hosted in collaboration with the Ashley Ashley Foundation, YME Bahamas. And essentially, we're kind of doing the same thing. So heading into COP28, I'd say the drawn out agenda topic will have a basis in loss and damage, because it took about 30 years for it to be founded. And loss and damage is essentially just the understanding and the application of accountability. It's individuals that are more so at the receiving end of the climate change crisis being afforded the opportunity to be reimbursed funds, assistance, support, whereas otherwise we would have had to take out countless loans and essentially rebuild and rebuild quickly whenever disasters strike. So basically, the whole mechanism behind that is something that's going to continuously be a topic until it's successfully implemented, barring the challenges that are currently going on with it. So this conference is essentially going to be a testament similar to last year, in which we come together and we strive to build capacity where applicable and where possible, especially from a youth perspective. So heading into COP28, we'd again have that capacity necessary for the conversations and dialogues and information that'll be disseminated.
Speaking of capacity, I found it very interesting, Stephen, when you were referring earlier in the show to the event that happened where you were exposing or expanding the discussion about using emerging technology and 3D printing as we attempt to have practices and habits that are more sustainable, right? So that we can protect and preserve our earth. What has been your experience with how you our youth have warmed up to emerging technology or existing technology as a way to incorporate sustainability a little bit more and more consistently into how we live?
So as you know, we live in a digital age, and this is a digital generation. So if you want to get across an issue so important as climate change, that's, like I said again, is going to disproportionately affect young people, it's important to utilize technologies and techniques that's going to grab their attention. So the 3D printing aspect of that particular workshop worked really well, and a few other technologies are on the horizon, but we want to make it applicable to our Bahamian context. We don't want to bring in things that, that isn't practical and that can't work in this particular space. So, but it's been very receptive from the students, and especially from the younger persons. So at the primary school level, at the junior school level, they've been very receptive of that and the importance of sustainability, like you said.
So I'm going to ask both of you something. If you had just 2 minutes to drive home why it is that youth involvement in this matter is so important in terms of the scourges that we're seeing now, what would you focus on? What would you say? How would you couch that message for me? I'm a young person. How would you seek to inspire me or encourage me to not only think deeply about how this my whole matter of climate change is impacting us on a real level, but what is my involvement and a responsibility in terms of helping to bring about positive action?
Okay, so I'll take that question first. So if I had 2 minutes to drive that point home, so I know it's pretty cliche to say, but the young people are the future of planet Earth. And they are the ones who are going to be around to really deal with the devastating effects of climate change. And I don't want to just preach doom and gloom about this issue. There is a lot of hope that still exists in terms of this climate fight, but we have to come together as not only as a Bahamian youth demographic, but in our region. And that's part of the reason we're here for this conference, is to build, foster greater collaboration internationally and regionally. So when we do go to these international conferences and we are, placed on the front lines with those bigger countries who are, mostly responsible for the climate crisis, we are singing one tune and we're unified and we're one voice. So that would be my message. And in addition to that, there's no planet B. So you have to take care of what we have as young people. So that would be my message to them.
To add to that, I definitely say that at the end of the day, what we have to understand, as Stephen would have mentioned, we are essentially the generation that will inherit this challenge. We're the first to actually, in real time, see how climate change can get exceedingly bad, and we will be the ones to see how much worse it can get. At the end of the day, especially here in the Bahamas, we always like to lean back on the fact that we are a Christian nation. And if you're going to use that as the basis for climate change, you've to continuously understand that, as Stephen mentioned, there is no second planet for us to go to. This is the one we were given. This is the one we were tasked with protecting. And we're not the only creatures on this planet. Our actions are going to continuously not just affect us, but every other species, both plant and animal, that share the space with us. At the end of the day, as young people, if we do not take into account how much it is we've been blessed with, especially in the Bahamas, if we don't forge that tangible appreciation for what we have, then essentially we do not deserve what it is we can maintain. If you do not take into account the blessings and the opportunities and the access that you currently have, you'll have no appreciation for what it is that can be lost. And I think that's one of the major issues. And it's really no fault of the younger generation. Let me preface by saying that, especially because if you don't know, you don't necessarily know how to do better. And that's something that we are continuously trying to foster, because if you cannot form a tangible basis of appreciation for what we're really losing, conch, coral reefs, coastlines, beaches, when it's gone is when you're really going to feel it. So we're really not just fighting for our future, we're fighting for our culture and our brand, because worst case scenario, and I don't want to preach gloom and doom, I really don't, but worst case scenario, if it does not go the way we want it to go, we will have to be tasked with keeping our culture alive somewhere else. And that sense of statelessness is something that I do not want for our generation. And I most certainly do not want for the generations to come. So that appreciation, that accountability, and that understanding is something that we're fighting for.
And shouldn't a part of that responsibility weigh heavily on on parents, on guardians, on our leaders, on civil society, to ensure that the awareness about this, but not only the awareness, that the action remains high? Are we doing all that we should be doing as a nation, as a country, as families, as communities, do you think?
Well, there's always room for improvement, for sure. But I definitely think more has to be done specifically on the front of getting the message across to the children in the more rural communities. We just came out of a session entitled Caribbean Storytelling and the usefulness in using storytelling to kind of portray the climate crisis, because it appeals to the emotion, and statistics and data might not always, resonate with people. It can go over some person's head. So storytelling and the importance of that was one of the things we spoke about. And one of our colleagues in the room mentioned the fact that why should persons of, a lower socioeconomic background even care about climate change when they have to worry about day-to-day survival? So I think that's an important statement, and we need to do more to get the message across to those people and the importance of why you should care about climate change. Why you should save the conch, why you should care about the environment, because those persons actually make up the majority. So if we want to affect meaningful change, we have to reach those persons in our community. And I'll let Ashanti add
But
more to
before you go,
that.
before we transition to Ashante, that is an actually a very good question. People are concerned about living from day to day, where the next meal is coming from, buying clothes and shoes, and making sure that their family has a roof over their head. How do you bridge the gap between those very real needs? And when you say something like climate change, that a lot of people may think is kind of like this nebulous thing that's all the way over there, and I really am not into that right now. Right now, I'm trying to figure out where I'm gonna get
What I
a
eat
dollar
next.
fifty exactly to buy some raw chicken to go home and cook for my family. So how do you bridge that gap?
Yeah, that is where it's been so much of a challenge, especially for countries like ours, because unfortunately, because of our geographic disposition, there are so many factors to take into account. And yes, from a socioeconomic standpoint, especially the further you move away from Nassau, and even in the intercities and communities within Nassau, you cannot go and have conversations from a one-sided perspective because you cannot tell somebody to appreciate their future if they're struggling to get through their present. And that's something that's been a continuous problem in the climate change space because, yes, we're trying to foster that meaningful connection. And yes, we're trying to build that basis for that future and international collaborations. But at the end of the day, if my choice to do something that would get me through today potentially impacts my future, 90% of the individuals tasked with that situation are going to make a choice that puts the future in further detriment simply because you have to live to see it. So it's really where policy and actual implementation are going to be really crucial because if the earnest is truly on our leaders and on our community activists and on the individuals that are tasked with authority and understanding to make meaningful change because, for example, let's talk about 3D printing. Yes, it's something that would be revolutionary, and yes, it's something that would truly have a greater understanding within our spaces. It's going to prove to be a basis for revitalizing sustainable agriculture for the main purpose in which we've been talking about it. But for Sally Mae that hasn't eaten since Monday, you cannot go into her community and tell her how a 3D printer would really and truly help to build materials for them to plant if they have nothing to literally put into the ground. They have nothing to harvest. They haven't eaten since Monday. So it's really where that emotional intelligence actually comes into play because you can educate and you can expose someone as much as you want, but if you're not taking into account their real-time present-day problems, they're going to be resentful towards anything that you implement or try to implement for their future because I have to keep my kids alive to see tomorrow. And if you're not going to assist or you're not able to enact meaningful change for today, the common behemoth is going to have no care for what it is you do in the future. And I think that's been the resounding resentment that's been building in the climate change space and why it's been giving such a Western world perspective. Because at the end of the day, if you don't make something digestible to a person in the sphere in which they're operating, it's going to serve no basis.
Very briefly, it goes back to also developing a greater appreciation for our natural world and our environment. If we can institute that in kids at a very young age, then you could kind of fill that gap because it becomes second nature for them to care about, not littering and preserving trees and, not attacking animals that are actually very important to the sustainability of our ecosystems, et cetera. So I think and that's something we should actually look forward to in our educational curriculum as we continue to incorporate more climate change materials.
As you mentioned, the aspect of protecting animals, it really does feed into so many sectors because it does support and create so much basis for the tragedy of the commons. Because, and what that essentially is in the world of economics is because a shared resource belongs to no one, it's essentially governed specifically by no one. And we see that so much of the time, especially every single time crawfish season opens, you'll see John, Joe, and James on the boat literally bringing in hundreds of basically any lobster that they see walking about, caring about its day, they will pull it back into the boat. And the conversation around it is, if I do not get mine, somebody else will get it. And that leaves me out of the conversation. So it does ultimately feed back into instilling that level of stewardship from the get-go
Correct, the
because,
social
yes,
responsibility.
because if you have no basis and you have no general societal code of conduct, especially for things that no one owns, They will, and they have continuously gone above and beyond to, I don't want to say the word abuse, but essentially it is an abuse on nature. It is an assault on nature. And whether we are conscious of it in real time, that's what it is. And for organisms that are not regulated, so like with so many stipulations as the crawfish, it's worse because if there's no governing principle, there's no governing law. Yeah, there are quotas, and yeah, there may be regulations. If there is no societal understanding and commitment, we will single-handedly fish something or capture something or kill something completely out of our ecosystem. And that will lead to a complete food web collapse, worst case scenario.
What the work that you and Stephen are doing and many others is hard work. It's grueling, but it's good work and it's necessary work. What have been the gains that you can identify? What are some of the things that we've been able to do in the Bahamas, a small island developing states, as blocks? What are some of the things that you can identify?
I can definitely say, looking back, especially over the course of the implementation of this ambassadorship, there has definitely been more understanding and more interest and investment in young people. And when I say that, I mean it in the sense of it from that multi-generational perspective. Because growing up, especially in the Bahamas, and you make known to your parents or your family members that you have an interest in going into environmental studies, you kind of get shot down pretty quickly. And that is, there is an understanding that they want you to be able to support yourself, whatever the case may be, but you're completely shooting down something that is essential, not just for our survival, but for the global space and communities. And what we've noticed, especially recently, this year particularly, there has been more investment in programs. There's been more investments in opportunities for young people to actually get into this space and not only have access to different educational programs and platforms, but various opportunities. They often say that yes, in obstacles and yes, in adversity, though as strenuous it may be, there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and obstacles often produce opportunities. And what we've definitely been able to chime into as young people has been the opportunities of this ambassadorship for one, and then the creation of our youth delegation to COP. So as Stephen would have mentioned, coming out of COP26, really and truly, it was the COP that turned the tides for young people. And in the Bahamas, it really did catalyze so many different opportunities and access points because one part of what happened literally came out of not being heard. It came out of being tokenized and being youth washed for so long to the point where the young people consistently came together and they just said, you know what, enough is enough. Since they're not going to listen to us from this perspective, we're going to try another approach. It produced the desired result. So this opportunity and the opportunities that have been created under the Davis administration for young people to not only formulate at COP27 the first youth delegation for the Bahamas, and now it's going to be the second youth delegation to COP, it's created a more conversation amongst young people. It's created a more aware perspective. Because yes, young people have noticed and have been noticing that something has been wrong, but we now have the words to actually attach to the situation. So that, I think that's one of the best things that have come out of the opportunities provided, that space to actually be heard.
Stephen, do you want to add to that?
I will actually, and just saying that expansion of the climate change space and the capacity building that we have seen over the course of the various workshops, as we would have mentioned, and the conference in July, just seeing that capacity being built among young persons who are interested in environment. And I always say you don't necessarily have to be interested in the environment to care about an issue like climate change, because it's a multifaceted issue. It's going to affect persons of all walks of life and all generations. So we have to ensure that we have to ensure that it's going to be heard in the climate change space. But also, going back to your previous question in terms of the gains, I don't really consider this work. It's more so like our civic duty and ensuring that this is done. So definitely seeing that capacity being built, because we understand with that capacity being built, We're getting closer and closer to effecting meaningful change. So when we go to these international conferences, we actually have more persons who are able to, effectively contribute to the discussion, whether it's in the negotiations or in an observer capacity. And this is how we can actually acquire that, climate funding that, we have been pushing for so much as small island development states as it relates to loss and damage. So that's one of the primary gains for me so far. But we have a few more months left in this ambassadorship. So later on, you could probably revisit that question as we reflect over the course of the year.
All right, we'd love to do that. So this is a very good point at which we are going to take our second break. But when we come back, we'll pick up this conversation and we'll talk about the premier international climate change conference, those crucial conversations, and how we connect conversations to action. We'll take a break and be back after this.
Chapter One Bookstore is proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies, and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our copy center for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael H. Eldon Complex on University Drive. Shop with us on Monday through Saturday. You can contact us at 397-2650 or email at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. Chapter One, the premier choice.
Back we are on University Drive for our final segment here, talking about climate change and the youth perspective with Ashante Russell and Stephen Hunter II. So you both are youth climate change ambassadors for the Bahamas, and there is a unit that you're attached to, the unit that is under the office of the Prime Minister. You've been involved in a whole lot of youth advocacy, education, raising awareness, participation at international and conferences, organizing and facilitating local talks and sessions. What's currently going on, and what are the next steps?
So for us currently, we are in the well, first, let me start by saying, yes, we are definitely attached to the Climate Change Environmental Advisory Unit of the Office of the Prime Minister. And we've been working continuously and closely with them to implement the a given proposal that we submitted to them. So when we came into this ambassadorship, Stephen and I drafted essentially what it was we wanted to accomplish in terms of reference. And we were given and afforded the opportunity to have a supporting committee. So within the scope of this committee, we have about seven islands represented, these being Grand Bahama, Eleuthera, Andros, Mayaguano, Inagua, Long Island. Now, yeah, we have a Central New Providence representative as well. Now, I will preface by saying these individuals have proven to be catalysts in everything that we've done, because in terms of everything that you've listed, we've done from logistics to planning and the implementation of the things that we proposed, it has definitely and understandably proven to be cumbersome when you're on the worst end of things. So they've definitely supported us and helped us to not only educate and expose young people across the country to what it is that we can do, but they've helped us to support the conversations about what we can continuously see and look forward to as young people enter this space. So that is one thing that I can truly say up to this point, we've had the absolute pleasure in being affiliated with. But in terms of everything else that we are in the process of doing, so coming after we return back to New Providence this weekend, we're going to be going more so into that hunkered down mode, getting ready for COP. So COP being the Conference of the Parties, that is essentially the climate conference that is looked forward to every year. And it comes with its pros and its cons, because for some people, it's definitely an event by which we're really hoping for that catalyzed change to be enacted. And then for others, it's sometimes treated as a, I want to say, over-glorified party, but that is basically what it sometimes comes to. But what we're planning on doing as the youth delegation, which has definitely expanded from last year, we are planning on having various conversations within the Bahamas Pavilion. So this year we actually have a pavilion at COP, and what that essentially is our own speaking and meeting space. Last year we would have occupied various other pavilions, so this year we have the opportunity to have our own. And we'll be engaging with the youth delegation in different conversations and discussions about issues and meeting points that we deem necessary, and definitely in support of the challenges and opportunities we've noticed around us. So that is going to be our driving factor, really heading into COP. And we'll be having those conversations, as well as the presentation of our completed manifesto coming out of the Bahamas Youth Climate Conference. So definitely going into that working mode to get everything together and organized, so when we present the perspectives and the needs and the understanding of the youth from the Bahamas, we literally do so to the best of our ability.
Yeah, so just to highlight what that manifesto really represents. So just like Ashanti would have said, it's representative of the youth perspective. So at the Bahamas Youth Climate Conference in July, we had a series of breakout sessions, and each breakout session was tailored around a different subject matter, obviously related to climate change and the environment. So we had topics like waste management, renewable energy technologies. I think we did sustainable agriculture again, and how coastal erosion as well. And we had all of these different perspectives. So at the end of each session, we actually gave all the persons in the room, all of the students, that being an opportunity to kind of make suggestions and highlight what challenges they face in their respective communities, specifically those in the family of islands, because like I said, we don't want this to be a Nassau-centric issue. So we have a lot of input from those students. And so over the past few months, we've actually been compiling that document, and we're in the final stage of consolidating this document, which will actually be the working document that we will take to COP and will be representative of the youth voices.
A lot of what you both do is having conversations, and you each of you is unique. How do you bring your unique experiences and aspirations to bear on the critical conversations that you're having? I'm interested.
Well, it's definitely something that, you know, after doing it so consistently, you don't even always notice that you're doing it. So I'm actually glad that you pointed out that question. So for me, honestly, I kind of refer back to what got me into this space. So pretty young, I really decided that I was going to be a scientist of some sort. And after realizing that the medical field was not for me, and I strive to go into the environmental space, my driving factor has and will always be preservation for people, preservation for the future. Because at the end of the day, you know, there's a guiding principle that was instilled in me when I went to school in Eleuthera. And it's literally learning to live well in a place, learning to leave the places that you occupy better than you originally met it. At the end of the day, yes, we all are afforded the equal responsibility as well as opportunity to do justice and do our best by our ecosystems, by our communities, though no one else, or not everyone else, will do it. Rather, when you have that understanding and that conscientious belief, you take that to heart. You take it really and truly to the core of you. So that's been really the driving thing for me, understanding that, yes, sometimes not everyone will listen and appreciate what I say, but knowing that for some people in the room, it will be the, I'd say, the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of them coming off of that fence, coming to the space of understanding that though I am one person, my actions can really and truly equate to such greatness if I move from that, I'd say, that fence line understanding as to what it is I'm responsible for as a person. Because yes, as an individual, you cannot fix all of the issues in the world alone. But if you come to the understanding that you have a choice to either add to it or add to the rectification of what was caused, you can collectively make a difference. So that's been it, as well as, you know, the comic Bahamian flair that always gets the room jumping. Yeah, they're always really happy when you're able to, especially, I think, being in the heat of it so much, especially coming out of Dorian when we go to different spaces and we talk, and they're like, you're always so jovial when talking about something that's literally threatening your lives. And I always tell them, you know, you can take it from this particular perspective. Yes, it's bad, but it could get a whole lot worse. And if I don't come to the understanding that, again, there are so many opportunities that exist in tragedy and adversity, you can't afford to kind of stay home and be sad about it. The ocean will literally come and claim you. I rather fight for a better tomorrow than kind of sit down and wait for it to get worse. It proves no benefit.
You're hopeful. And
Yes.
how do you engage the Stephen Hunter touch?
Yeah, so speaking to that uniqueness, first of all, you don't normally see a lot of male figures in this climate environmental space. So I think that was an important aspect of, you know, having me as one of the climate youth ambassadors, allowing young persons, specifically young men, see that you can actually be in this climate space too, because there is a kind of like a negative connotation surrounding that, hey, to care about the environment is feminine and it's, you know, for girls and all of that. So to kind of dispel that negative connotation and that misconception, it's important that, you know, you have a male figure here as also a youth climate ambassador. And in addition to that, being someone from the natural and physical sciences, like I mentioned earlier, I studied physics with mathematics, you don't necessarily see a lot of persons from that, you know, particular background get involved in the more social science aspect of things. So I think those two aspects actually speak to the uniqueness of it and actually shows the students that, hey, it doesn't matter what your background, what your career aspirations are, you can be involved in this space as well.
So over the last few years, especially, there's been a concerted effort by small island developing states and their leaders to have their voices elevated in the spaces and places that matter so that the world can understand that small island developing states are feeling the effects of climate change in the worst ways, in the very worst ways. Elevating the youth voice has been a part of that. What do we need to do to make sure that the world continues to understand that these small island developing states need to be heard and what they are appealing for need to not only be considered, but put into action?
Well, in the shortest and most effective way I can answer that question, we have to be present. And yes, that comes with so many conversations, especially back home. You know, we always say, you know, you guys are going here, you're going there, you're going everywhere. And yes, sometimes it can be done in a virtual setting and capacity, but in some instances, you have to be there. There was a saying that I heard by the solution prime minister earlier this year, if you're not at the table, you're going to be on the menu. And that's been consistently what's been happening. Because we're not in the rooms and spaces, other people are advocating for us. And they're not advocating for our benefit. They're making choices that directly impact us presently and future-wise, because the perspective is, since you're not there, it's clearly it cannot be affecting you when that's not the case. So we have to continuously be present when it matters and when it's most meaningful. There are some engagements where we don't necessarily have to be physically in the room, but for the ones that constitute the actual preservation of our people, of our culture, of our future, we have to be there, and we have to be, as they often tell us in the Caribbean, loud and resounding and bolstered, because if we play the cat and mouse game and the mouse stays in the hole, we will not make it. And that's something that has been, that's something that's been really and truly repeated and reiterated over and over again, because as young people, especially coming into these spaces, you'll begin to really and truly notice that if you're in the room and you don't speak up, someone else will speak for you. Someone else will implement something or try to implement something that will directly affect you. And it makes it more real, because if I'm in the room and you're doing that, and you're aware that I'm in the room and you're doing that, I can only imagine what it is you're doing when I'm not there.
Stephen, how do we not be on the menu?
like my colleague would have shared, we have to be in the room. And just to highlight some of the challenges that exist to be in those rooms, at a previous conference, climate change conference, that is, a particular country had over 300 persons as a part of their delegation, when our country, the Bahamas, only had 6. So you can see kind of the dichotomy that exists when it comes to small and developing states and larger countries at these conferences. So we are already, you know, playing from behind. So I think at the very least, we need to be there, be in the room, so we can actually contribute to the discussions effectively and highlight the challenges that we face. I mean, there's no secret that what's happening to small and developing states, but we have to continue to be that voice. We have to continue to set that paradigm, because if, like my colleague said, if we remain silent, no change will happen.
All right. And so in the last few moments that we have, I'm going to turn it over to both of you to give us some wrap-up comments. But I'll just ask that you kind of focus in your wrap-up on the urgency of now.
So really and truly, if not now, then when? If we don't make the decision to act as catalysts of change now, we won't have anything to change in the future. We won't have anything to stress about, to fight over, to lobby for. If we don't make the sometimes difficult decision to change things for the better today, so that tomorrow can be a whole lot easier, though it may still have its challenges. And we're not saying that if we act today, everything will magically change tomorrow. That's not how it works. But if we do not give it an honest try, if we do not have honest conversations and actually make the effort to not only endorse non-state actors, governmental officials, and most importantly, and I say most importantly, the youth demographic, we will continuously be kicking the can down the road. And is that not what got us in this situation to begin with? People saying that, hey, we're going to do it tomorrow. Hey, we're going to fix it in a couple of months. 30 years passed before they actually allowed loss and damage to be an agenda topic at COP. That means for 3 decades, individuals were kind of dancing around accountability. We're dancing around the reality of small island developing states. And not because they didn't know, it's just they chose to do it tomorrow, or they chose to do it when it was convenient for them. Tomorrow is not always convenient for the individuals that are fighting for today. So if we do not actively make that choice to be accountable and to make meaningful contributions today, we will not have a tomorrow to do it in.
Yeah, so yeah, just to piggyback off what Shanti would have said, in terms of the urgency of now, if we continue to kick the can down the road, eventually there will be no more road left. So we have to, I don't know how many of the listeners are familiar with the 1.5 degree to stay alive phrase. That comes from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a group of scientists who studies the climate and does research, and they give that important information to the UN body. So 1.5 degrees is basically the average global temperature rise above the pre-industrial revolution. And we are tinkering around 1.1 or 1.2. And if we continue on this current trajectory, we will not be able to stay below that 1.5 degree threshold. And the impacts of that are severe, especially for small and developing states like the Bahamas. We will lose 80% of our coral if we make the 1.5. So surpassing that will actually exterminate our coral reefs, which, as you know, is an important marine habitat for many of the conch and the Nassau grouper and the snapper, the things that we like so much. So the urgency is very much still here, and we must strive, although it's ambitious at this point, to keep that 1.5 degrees Celsius goal alive. We have to start now. We have to start today.
All right. Very good. That is an excellent note to end on. Choose collective responsibility and choose survival. Ashante Russell, Stephen Hunter II, thank you both for joining us as guests on University Drive. Thank you all also to our listeners. Thanks for joining us and tuning in and staying connected. Continue to listen out to University Drive. I've been your host, Tamika Lundy. See you again next time, right here.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.